From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, April 1865, the month that could have unraveled our nation, but instead saved it. We talk with historian Jay Winnick. His best-selling book is about the month in which the Civil War ended and President Lincoln was assassinated. Also, we talk with journalist Andrew Croma about starting an independent radio station during the Civil War in his country, Sierra Leone. His station has been fired on, he's been abducted, and during the 1996 Democratic election, he had to broadcast his Get Out and Vote message while hiding in the bush. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush today told Congress he wants education legislation and a patient's bill of rights before lawmakers start their summer vacation next month. The president used a White House appearance to spell out his priorities as lawmakers return to the Capitol from their July 4th recess. The House and Senate must reconcile their separate versions of the administration's plan to use federal aid as leverage with failing schools and measure school performance by annual testing of students in math and reading. A congressional study released today finds that some of the voting disparities encountered in Florida during the 2000 presidential election are a national problem. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
A report from Democrats on the House Governmental Reform Committee found that ballots cast by poor and minority voters were more likely to go uncounted than the ballots of more affluent voters. The study looked at presidential voting patterns in 20 states. It concluded that while some ballots were not counted because there was no vote or too many votes for president, more often ballots were thrown out because voting machines failed to accurately record voters' intentions. California Congressman Henry Waxman, the ranking Democrat on the committee, called the disparities an outrage and an urgent national priority that should be addressed by the federal government. He said the problem is the result of older and less dependable voting machines being used in poorer neighborhoods. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The California Assembly today voted unanimously to ask Congress to apologize to Black Americans for slavery. The resolution approved today by the state lawmakers also called on Congress to establish a national museum and study whether to pay reparations. At least four people have been injured. Hundreds more have been evacuated after part of an oil refinery near San Antonio, Texas, caught fire. Officials are worried by a plume of acid created by the fire that's being released into the air. Kathy Coulihan of Texas Public Radio has the latest.
Company officials say the blaze began about noon. As it continues to burn, a plume of hydrofluoric acid is being released into the air. James Youngman is the Area Emergency Management Coordinator.
It's continuing to release right now, and they're trying to control everything right now. But until we stop the release completely, I don't expect the plume to dissipate. It's by far the worst acid that you might encounter, at least that I'm aware of.
The refinery is located about 70 miles southeast of San Antonio in the city of Three Rivers. Officials don't expect evacuees to be returned for several hours. For NPR News, I'm Kathy Coulihan in San Antonio.
Stock prices closed generally higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 46 points to close at 10,299 on volume of about a billion shares. Meanwhile, the Nasdaq was up 22 points, closing at 2026. You're listening to NPR News. Bulldozers leveled 14 Palestinian homes under construction today. It was one of Israel's biggest demolition operations in years and provoked outrage and stone throwing at a refugee camp on the northern edge of Jerusalem. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, a Palestinian suicide bomber died when his truck exploded, apparently before reaching its target. The attempt led Israeli officials to criticize the Palestinian leadership. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
The blast occurred as the militant was driving toward an Israeli army post, but injured no one else. Security officials suggested the rigged bomb may have been detonated too early. Israel's government says it had passed information to the Palestinian Authority about the planned attack, including the name of the militant and the place of the explosion, but officials say the PA did nothing to prevent it. Palestinians say they have now detained an accomplice of the bomber. In Israel, outside Tel Aviv, reports of another possible bombing caused massive traffic jams at the international airport. Security officials began checking everyone who entered. Desperate passengers caught in a miles-long backup toted their luggage along a main highway to make their flights. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
A consumer advocacy group is issuing a warning about eating raw oysters from the Gulf of Mexico. The Center for Science and the Public Interest says oysters from the Gulf should be cooked or treated to kill a deadly bacteria. Caroline Smith-DeWall says consumers can't afford to wait any longer for industry action. But the Food and Drug Administration says the only consumers who need to avoid raw Gulf oysters are those especially vulnerable to the bacteria. They include diabetics, people with liver disease, or suppressed immune systems. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing customized approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America, on the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Historian Jay Winnick is the author of the bestseller, April 1865. He describes it as the month in American history that could have unraveled the American nation, but instead saved it. It was the most decisive month of the Civil War and perhaps in the life of the United States. On April 9th, Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox. But the war wasn't over yet. It could have continued, Winnick says, for months or years. In less than a week after Appomattox, President Lincoln was assassinated, adding to the chaos and uncertainty of the time. Jay Winnick is a senior scholar at the University of Maryland's School of Public Affairs and is a contributor to the Wall Street Journal. He was an advisor to the late Congressman and Defense Secretary Les Aspin. While he was a senior staff member with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Winnick witnessed civil wars around the world. Those wars inspired him to write about our own civil war.
When I set out to write my book, everyone said to me, "What do you have to say about the Civil War? You're not even a Civil War historian per se." And that's really quite true. But because in a previous lifetime I had actually traveled to a number of civil wars, El Salvador, in Nicaragua, dissolving Yugoslavia, Cambodia, which was the site of the killing fields, I had a number of sort of intimate and personal experiences seeing the kind of dynamics of civil wars and how they sort of just flame out of control. And as a result of that, it both inspired me and gave me really fresh insights when I turned around and set my sights on the American Civil War.
Did seeing the outcome of other countries' civil wars make the outcome of the United States Civil War seem even more remarkable?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, throughout history, what one finds is far too many civil wars end quite badly with terrible, tragic consequences. Think of Northern Ireland, which has gone on for some 200 years. Think of Rwanda or Lebanon or Cambodia. Or think of the horrors today, whether it be in the Middle East or in the Balkans. Well, our civil war could have ended just as badly with the same terrible, fateful consequences, and indeed almost did. And that it didn't really does make the story of April 1865 such a remarkable story.
Well, let's look at April of 1865. That's the month that Confederate General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union General Ulysses S. Grant. That happened on April 9th of 1865. What was the circumstances behind Lee's defeat?
What happens is in the beginning of April, Lee's forces were being besieged for some 9 months in Richmond and Petersburg by U.S. Grant. And Lee had actually devised a very kind of daring plan in which he had decided he would take his troops down south, 140 miles, hook up with another Confederate general, and from there they would take to the hills and actually potentially wage a guerrilla war. And everything the Union was doing was to forestall that possibility. Indeed, early in the month, Lincoln said to U.S. Grant and to General Sherman that one of his greatest fears really was that the Confederates would wage guerrilla war. And a series of events would happen during those first days of that month where Lee is doing everything to escape. And, I mean, indeed, there's at one point where the surrender seems potentially to be getting closer, where his men are slowly being encircled. And three of Lee's top generals come up to Lee, and they raise the possibility of that most dreaded of all words, which was surrender. And Lee looks at them, and he thunders very coldly, and he says, "Surrender? No, never. Our men fight far too bravely ever to think of surrender." And then when it does become apparent, though, that that they are encircled on the east side, on the west side, on the south side, and the only way they can go is north, the only direction they don't want to go in. It's at that point where Lee convened a council of war, and this proves to be one of the most fateful and really most, one of the most important meetings in all of American history. Lee sits down with some of his closest aides, and one of his aides says to him, "No, we shouldn't surrender." He said, "We should take to the hills like partridges and rabbits, and a little more bloodshed now will make no difference." Now, when Lee sat down to weigh this decision before he would decide what to do, he had to think, firstly, could they do it? Could the South do it? And in the end, Lee decided that that was too much. It would not only destroy, he will then say, sitting down with his aides, he will say that a guerrilla war like that would not only destroy the North, but it would destroy the South. And quite presciently, he says, it would take many generations for this country to recover. And at that point, he sort of sat up and he sort of straightened himself and said, "And now I must go meet General Grant and surrender, and I would rather die 1,000 deaths than do that." And of course, what's so fascinating about all this is that we tend to think about Lee as being a great military man, and certainly he was that, or a great tactician, and certainly he was that. But arguably, his finest moment comes not in war, but it comes in peace and saying no to a destructive guerrilla war. And it's at that point that he would go to meet General U.S. Grant.
You praise both Grant and Lee for how they handled themselves at Appomattox, in which, Lee officially surrendered. What was the terms of the surrender?
Yeah. Once Lee makes this decision that he's not going to wage guerrilla war, and he says, "And now I must go meet General Grant," it's funny because that morning he would don his finest uniform because, as he says, "I must now meet General Grant, and I will surely be his prisoner." Well, how will Grant treat him? You know, this has been too often telescoped in history. But in fact, we know that morning, General Lee was actually quite nervous. And well, he should have been nervous, because throughout history, defeated generals, defeated traitorous generals, defeated rebels, more often than not in history, had been beheaded, or they had been hung, or they had been imprisoned, or like General Napoleon, they were exiled. And in fact, that very morning, the Chicago Tribune editorialized, "Hang Lee," and just days earlier in the steps of the patent office in the Union Capitol of Washington, D.C., the Vice President, Andrew Johnson, gave a rousing speech to about 1,000 in which he said, "We must hang Lee, we must hang Davis, we must hang them 20 times. So Lee did not necessarily, from history, he had much to fear. But if this were surely Lee's finest moment in saying no to guerrilla war, on this day that will also be U.S. Grant's finest moment. Grant finally comes in, and he's actually wearing a mud-spattered private's bus. Now, what's so fascinating, consider the dynamics. Here is Lee. Lee, who is in many ways the sole scion of the founding father of George Washington and Martha Washington, and he's surrendering to the son of a tander, U.S. Grant, who had been a failure most of his life. I mean, it's really an American story. And interestingly enough, what they do is, in the beginning, is they actually talk about the old days. They talk about the Mexican War. Grant talks about how he remembers meeting Lee, because even back then, Lee was a great figure. And Lee at one point says, "You know, I tried to recall your face all these times during battle, and I could never quite do it." And they're talking so long and so happily that at one point it is not Grant but Lee who says, "I suppose we should discuss the object of why we're here, the surrender." And at that point, Grant will just handle himself really brilliantly and really presciently. He does several things that are quite important for us to look at. Firstly, he allows the defeated rebels to keep their sidearms. Now, this makes no sense militarily, and it makes no sense tactically if you are worried about the South waging guerrilla war, as Jefferson Davis was calling for. But what U.S. Grant was saying is we may have defeated you, but we still honor you. We may have defeated you, but you are still our countrymen. He also enables, upon a personal plea from Lee himself, the defeated rebels to keep their horses. Again, this makes no sense tactically or militarily if you are worried about guerrilla war. But once again, Grant is saying, you are to be our countrymen again. But the most poignant moment of all will happen when the two pieces of paper are exchanged and then the surrender is roughly concluded, and Lee will shake hands with every man in this Wilbur McLean house. And at that point, he starts to walk out. U.S. Grant comes out. Grant makes eye contact with him, and he tilts his hat in surrender, a gesture that is then mimicked by all these tens and hundreds and thousands of soldiers around him. And this one small gesture will soon ricochet and echo in every little home and household in the South, setting the tone for the healing to come. But of course, what's so crucial to remember at this point, as we said earlier, that Lee has only surrendered his army. There are still three Confederate armies in the field, over 175,000 men, and the situation is still quite volatile.
Do you think that when Grant allowed Lee and his men to keep their arms and keep their horses, that Grant was taking his cue from Lincoln?
Yeah. Just before April 1865 began, Lincoln would have a crucial meeting with U.S. Grant and Sherman to talk about the war, when it will end, how it will end, and what is to happen when it finally does end. And in this meeting, he says several things. Firstly, he talks about his fear of guerrilla war. Secondly, he worries that there will be a final bloody Armageddon, and Grant will say, Lee being Lee, there will be a final bloody Armageddon. But then thirdly and most importantly, and again, here is where Lincoln really shines as much as any time in a war. Lincoln says, you know, when this war ends, there must be no bloody work, there must be no hangings, there must be none of that. And of course, what Lincoln was thinking about was the French Revolution, which was heavy on everyone's minds. And Lincoln was saying, that must not happen here. So in effect, what Grant was doing was he was carrying out the vision of tenderness and magnanimity that Lincoln had laid out for him earlier, just before April 1865.
When Lee surrenders to Grant, this does not quite end the Civil War, because there are still Confederates in the field fighting. Who's left in the Confederacy?
Yeah, there are still three Confederate armies in the field, scattered in different departments, both in the South as well as in the West. There's really over 175,000 men. There are three separate generals who will be sort of determining this. And what's so crucial to remember is that even at that point, and just to give a little example, no less than Robert E. Lee's wife, Mary Lee, who is directly descended from Martha Washington, and by marriage, of course, from George Washington himself, she is the step-great-granddaughter of Washington. She will say, Lee is not the Confederacy, Richmond is not the Confederacy. So as Lincoln knew and feared, the situation was still quite volatile. How much longer would the war last? A week? 3 weeks? A month, 6 months? Well, as Lincoln knew and feared, such time spans had been enough in history to start, fight, and win wars, to unseat great dynasties, or to complicate the reconciliation to come. And in fact, as if on a mournful script, that's what would happen just 5 days later.
How did the three remaining Confederate generals end up surrendering?
Yeah, what they will eventually do is they will eventually get word of Lee's surrender. And one by one, they will reject Jefferson Davis's call for a continued guerrilla war, because Davis's government was on the run and he was continuing to sort of call for a continuation of this war in the most deadly fashion possible through partisan warfare. And yet, rather than following him, the generals would follow the words and the spirit and the actions of General Lee.
My guest is historian Jay Winnick. His new book is called April 1865. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jay Winnick. He's the author of the new book, April 1865, about the month that ended the Civil War. Just 5 days after Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox, President Lincoln was assassinated. What were the motives, as far as you know, of John Wilkes Booth in assassinating Lincoln? How much did that have to do with Lee's surrender?
Yeah, no, it had a lot to do with Lee's surrender, and this is one of the most fascinating and too little explored nights, really in American history. You know, it's 5 days after the surrender of Lee, but not only is it the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, but consider what else happens on that same evening, the same time at night at 10:14. Not only one, but three deadly assassins would fan out to strike. One assassin, John Wilkes Booth, will murder Abraham Lincoln. Another assassin will stab five times the Union Secretary of State, William Seward, and a third assassin will be prepared to plunge a knife into Andrew Johnson's heart, Andrew Johnson, the Union Vice President, but only at the last second he gets cold feet. And what happens is what John Wilkes Booth eventually hoped would happen, is that he would sow anarchy and chaos and somehow prolong this war and maybe sort of undo the surrender that happened when Lee surrendered. And in fact, he almost succeeded.
Well, describe Washington, D.C. after the assassination.
Yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating. What's so important is for us to see it not as we do with the comfort of hindsight in the most powerful, regularized, institutionalized democracy in the world, but to see it through their eyes. And on that night, Once Lincoln was shot and assassinated, and Seward was stabbed 5 times, and Johnson was targeted, the Union was in such chaos that people literally feared being murdered in their beds. Indeed, the Chief Justice would say it was a night of horrors, and in fact, it was a night of horrors. Indeed, there was such chaos and turmoil that night in Washington that the Union cabinet would soon be discussing whether or not, in effect, a Napoleonic coup was underway. And of all people, they actually thought their own great general, Bill Sherman, was behind it. And in fact, the New York Times would write that evening, or actually the next day, I should say, they would write that if this were France, all of the country would be in bloody revolution by the next day. So there was really a lot that had to be handled that evening. And then in addition to that, there's one other thing, the transition to who becomes president, because it was actually far murkier than we tend to think of it.
Well, you know, I think there were two things. A minimum of 2 things that could have gone wrong. First of all, the assassination could have opened up an opportunity for the Confederates to resume the war. But second of all, there were cries in the North for revenge against Lincoln's murder, cries of revenge that could have also led to chaos.
Right. It potentially could have led to the very scenario that Lincoln never wanted, which is this kind of bloodbath of retribution and vengeance and hangings and all the rest. And that was one thing that had to be avoided. Another thing was the opportunity to continue the war, because at the point that this decapitation of the Union government is taking place, General Lee is back in Richmond safely at his home. And if Lee were a Milosevic or Yasser Arafat, or you pick your favorite strongman on the world stage today, you can bet that he surely would have taken advantage of this to perhaps give a wink and nod and say, let's try a little guerrilla warfare and take advantage of this fleeting weakness.
Now, there's a lot of concern that Andrew Johnson, although he was picked by Abraham Lincoln to be the vice president, there was concern that Johnson would be a terrible president. Why were so many people so worried?
Well, for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Johnson had only met with Lincoln once. And quite by happenstance, that was on the day that when Lincoln was assassinated for only 30 minutes. And to this day, we don't know what they talked about. But more importantly, Johnson was a relative newcomer to the administration. He wasn't of the Republican Party. He was an outsider. And more than anything else, Johnson was widely written off as a drunkard and a buffoon in the Washington establishment. And he was a man who nobody ever thought of as being president. And when he assumed it, people were really kind of stunned.
Well, what do you think saves the day after Lincoln's assassination and prevents the Confederates from taking up arms again and prevents the North from seeking revenge for the murder of Lincoln?
Yeah. No, that's really a good question. I mean, if we look around the world today at the civil wars that seem to kind of persist with this melancholy regularity, what we see is it always takes two sides to create the peace. And in our case, in April 1865, we would be fortunate to have leaders on two different sides who would really do much to sort of create the healing and the reconciliation. First and foremost, more than anyone, there was Abraham Lincoln, who really did have the genius and the foresight and the wisdom to know that how this war ends is every bit as crucial as how it was fought. And it was Lincoln who talked about binding up the wounds. It was Lincoln who said at City Point to Grant and Sherman, there must be no bloody work, there must be no hangings. So even when Lincoln was assassinated and when Lincoln was dead, it would be Lincoln's vision that would sort of guide the surrenders where the Northern generals would receive their counterparts, foremost Grant, who acted brilliantly at Appomattox. But General Sherman would also act equally with magnanimity and dignity at Durham Station when he receives Joe Johnston's surrender. And so these leaders will do much in the North to kind of quell the calls for vengeance and for hatred. In fact, at one point, General Lee is actually indicted, and Grant will step forward and say if Lee is indicted and stands, he raised the specter of he could even resign. He said it must not happen, and so the indictment was quashed. And then equally important is that there was not only these men on the northern side, but on the southern side. Robert E. Lee, having always been the nemesis for Abraham Lincoln, ironically will become Lincoln's partner in peace at the end of the war, because Lee will do much to kind of continue the efforts to quell this the continuation of the war through a deadly guerrilla effort.
Of course, one thing we have to consider is that when the Civil War ended and the United States was unified again, the South started to erect really racist laws, and although slavery was illegal, African Americans still had few, if any, rights in the South for quite a while.
Yeah, no, no. What would later follow was just a tragedy in every way, shape, and form. And one of the ways I think about this is I think, you know, had Lincoln lived, he would have wept at the tragedy of Reconstruction, and he would have seen it as a flawed nightmare in every respect. I also think he would have wept at some of what happened in the North as well, where there were also continuing elements of racism, just in a different form from what happened in the South. But there is no doubt that the continuing struggle for civil rights and for true freedom and true equality would really take another 90 or 100 years, and of course many argue that it's a struggle that continues to this day. But what's crucial to remember is that's a very different kind of chapter and story than us becoming like a Northern Ireland or a Middle East or a Balkans.
You used to work in government as an aide to Les Aspin. Have your views of American government changed, or American leadership changed, as a result of writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, I've changed in all sorts of ways. A lot of things I used to think when I was in government, I don't think anymore after having spent 4 years reflecting on how this country kind of emerged out of the turmoil of the Civil War and somehow survived. What I really come out of this believing is people make history. Leaders, men and women. And you know, there's a reason, I guess, why we have such bitter debates over who becomes president or over who becomes our most senior general or over who takes cabinet positions, because it's not simply just the policies or the government per se, but if men and women at the top decide to pervert the institutions of government, they could do that. But in the final analysis, I think it's really these people who at crucial moments are either shaped by history or shape history. And here we really see why leadership so matters. I mean, I'm convinced that April 1865 isn't a final analysis, a story of leadership on both sides.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Jay Winnick is the author of April 1865. He's a senior scholar at the University of Maryland's School of Public Affairs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, starting an independent radio station in Sierra Leone during the Civil War, reporting on fear campaigns and atrocities while the station was under fire. We meet Andrew Croma, the founder and the main voice of Sierra Leone's KISS 104.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Andrew Cuomo founded an independent radio station in his country, Sierra Leone, 8 years ago during its civil war. He now runs two stations. The one in Freetown, the capital city, has been burned down twice. The station in Bo, Sierra Leone's second largest city, has been attacked with gunfire and was temporarily closed down and forced into exile. That's just part of the punishment Cuomo has faced for keeping listeners informed about corruption and atrocities. Cuomo is often on the air, broadcasting from his station in Bo. He's one of the investigative reporters who reports under the house name of Mr. Owl. Cuomo grew up in the bush and has studied in the U.S. at the University of Texas and Duke University. I spoke with him last week during his trip to the United States to study public radio here. I asked him about covering Sierra Leone's democratic election in 1996, when the rebels were mounting a campaign of terror to scare people away from voting. As part of this campaign, the rebels amputated the arms of thousands of men, women, and children. I asked Cuomo how his station in Bo covered the story.
On the day of election, that was when we were on the air telling people to go out and vote. It is your right. You need it. You need a government. The military government need to go out. We don't need a military government. It's not democratic. That day, we were shot at. The combatants came up to the station. It was just about 100 yards away. And the man who was standing beside me as a security was killed. I mean, this was like 2 feet away from me, and bullets kept coming up. So we had to tilt the microphone over the speaker of the VHF radio. We ran into the bush, and we were still broadcasting from the bush where guns were being shot, I mean, fired. But the message at that time was to tell the people that go out and vote, because our broadcast was getting to the villages where voting was taking place. We didn't want that incident closer to our station to stop that. So we continued. People were being amputated. In fact, very close to the station, there was a village next door, not too far away. We could hear the people screaming, but we still continued to be on the air to broadcast.
Did you try to warn people about the possibility of amputation?
Yes, we did. When we go on the air and we get information about danger areas, we tell people about those danger areas, and we are able to tell them where safer areas are due to the interviews we conduct.
Do you still see a lot of people walking around now who were amputated during that 96 election?
Oh, yes. Children, women. I personally have witnessed amputations. I thought I was going to be the next. We've seen these things happen, and we've interviewed victims. I mean, we are talking about, at the time, blood is dripping from the arm or the leg. We've interviewed them. We have also had the opportunity to interview the perpetrators, why they do it.
What are some of the things the perpetrators have told you?
Most of these people were just senseless. They didn't even know. They were just saying that the civilians don't like them, they don't support them, so there is going to be Operation No Living Thing. So I will ask them questions like, then how will you govern No Living Thing? I said, well, until we find out that people change. That's like, but is that the way you're going to get people to change? These are the hard questions that we ask. And the reason why you ask them is because you want them to give out pertinent information that people can know how these people perceive themselves.
Now, I understand that during the military takeover in 1997, that the citizens of Bo, where you live, refused to accept the rule of the rebels who had taken over. And that your radio station became the only source of information for the city, because the city was basically cut off from the rest of the country during this 9-month rule of the military?
Yes, it was a matter of deciding whether we should resume broadcasting or not. Because that area was being protected by the Civil Defense Force, so it was safe. It was safer for us to broadcast from there. And we used that radio station to tell the people that a military government is not your answer. To tell the people that you have the right to elect a civilian government and that don't support that government at all. That was very brave of us. And we did that and did that. We became successful. People had a sit-down strike. Nobody went to work. We had to go into exile finally and then resume broadcast again in 1998 when the democratically elected government was reinstalled.
Sierra Leone is a very dangerous place to practice journalism. It's probably particularly dangerous for you. You're both the founder of a radio station and an investigative reporter on that radio station. How do you protect yourself? Do you carry a gun?
No. No, you don't. What you carry is your ID to show that you are a reporter for the radio station.
But that's part of the reason why they want to hurt you, because they know you're a reporter.
Well, in most cases, when they want to hurt me, I tell you, if you hurt me, nobody is going to know what you want to do. I am here. You don't pay me. But I know you want people to know why you're caught in their hands. You want people to know why you are burning their houses. So if you kill me, how will people know how you perceive? That has been personally my survival.
No, tell me. Let me stop you. Has that actually worked sometime?
Yes, it has worked. Me and my I have a very young wife, very beautiful wife, with two young children. When my wife gave birth to my son, Anel, we decided to take the children to show to our parents. But there was no way we couldn't afford to go by air. But because I believe that I can go through the West Side Boys, these were soldiers that were recalcitrant, very notorious guys. I set on the journey. I put my family in the car. Before I could start the car, my son, Abdul Karim, 5 years old by then, said, "Daddy, let's pray before we start the car." So I said, "Okay." So he prayed for the trip, that the trip would be okay. "God, please guide my father, guide us, protect us on the way." After that, I started the car. And when we were abducted that day, it came into my mind. For about 2 hours, I was negotiating our release. I was letting them to know that I'm not there as an enemy. If I'm an enemy, why would I come to you? Why would I come through your area anyway? I'm just a journalist. I work for Kiss Radio. Don't you know Kiss Radio? Don't you listen to Kiss Radio? One or two people said, "Yes, you don't like us. You tell us that we are killing people." I said, "But yes, you're killing people, but the other side is also killing people. So, but you have a reason why you're doing it. You're just not killing people." He said, "Yes." They reasoned out to me. So I said, "Well, do you want an interview? Because I need to let the people know what you are doing these things for." That saved me. The ID card that I'm a journalist, and especially so the institution that I work for that believe in the truth.
So did you interview the people who were interrogating you?
Yes, I interviewed them. And again, you see, they must rely on you. I told them that I will air their messages. I aired it out, and then I went to the government side, interviewed the Minister of Defense, and he also granted the interview. He was very nice that he actually appealed to them to see reason to stop the atrocities, and that if they don't, then they will pursue them anyway. So you see, these messages go from one side to another side, but being in between as a journalist, the only thing that will save you is the truth. And I think you must identify yourself that, yes, this is what I do.
So the rebels who had abducted you and your family, when you interviewed them, what was one of the main points that they wanted to make in that interview?
They wanted to let the people know that the government owed them salaries. They wanted to let the people know that the government is illegitimate, and that they want a transition government that will protect them. That if they don't have a government that will protect them, then they will continue because they were afraid of revenge. They have caused so much atrocity. These are the guys who burned down Freetown, January 6, 7, and 8, who caused the worst atrocities in the world. I mean, we're talking about killing, burning children, burning grandparents in their houses. Within 3 days, they burned about over 5,000 people. These are the people I'm talking about. So they got the chance to tell the world or the country that they were doing this because they were, first of all, the government don't like them, the people don't like them, and they want a government of a transition government that will protect them from revenge. And I put that on the air.
So you put that on the air, and then you interviewed the government and put their response on
yes,
the air.
Ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. Did you get any reaction from the rebels after the broadcast?
No, it keep going. You solve one problem today, and you have a bunch of problems. You have news coming from other areas. So it's like it keep going. It's the mission. It's the journey. You keep going until you find out that peace comes. And we were very happy when UN came.
When the UN
and
came?
I knew that was going to be the answer when UN came in.
What difference do you think the United Nations has made in Sierra Leone?
Three international institutions made, communities made a big difference. The United States government, by threatening to prosecute all perpetrators for crime against humanity, that was one of the strongest, because I remember interviewing Ambassador Schaefer, who was ambassador-at-large for war crimes. Then the British government and the American government really told these people that this is wrong that you are doing. The United Nations deployed the largest peacekeeping force ever deployed anywhere in the world. And they were ready to make sure that peace returned to the country. I think they really made a very, very remarkable impact on the country. Today, as I'm sitting here, I made a phone call this morning. Disarmament is going on, this demobilization is going on, and people are reintegrating. We must coexist.
My guest is Andrew Kroma, the founder of two independent radio stations in his country, Sierra Leone. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Kroma, and he founded and runs a radio station in Sierra Leone, in the city of Bo. And the radio station specializes in investigative reporting, in reporting on the rebels, reporting on the government, and there's been a lot of reprisals against the radio station because it has angered people on all the sides in its attempt to tell the truth. What are some of the reports you have done lately that are very risky and controversial?
Like, for instance, there is massive corruption going on in the country, and we think that must stop. We have put on air, revealed, I could say, acts of corruption by the government. We have revealed serious atrocities that were usually unknown to other people, that we exposed this, and we figured those are very dangerous. There was a recent one with us and the power company. We have an arrangement with the power company, the electricity company, to provide us electricity, and we cannot trade. If they come in with announcement, we hear the announcement, and then they deduct it from how much we owe them. Simply because the economy is really, really bad. You cannot depend on advertisement revenue for operation. This time around, there was storm, and an electric pole was knocked down. The cable, naked cable, was lying down there. A child was killed.
A child was killed?
Yes.
By this live wire?
Yeah, by the live wire, he was killed. So we reported that strictly in the news. And then Mr. Al went on the air to
I should explain. Mr. Al is your investigative journalist persona.
Yeah,
Mr. That's
Al
the name
the
you use.
Yeah, that's the name we use. It's Mr. Al. Mr. Al, we even see what is happening and describe it there and then, and it's on the air. So people really listen to it. It's one of our most listened programs. This time around, Mr. Al reported that BKPS must be held liable because we found out that they were informed about the live wire lying down there and they did not disconnect it. The children, the school children, after the funeral ceremony, were returning home and they still saw the live wire lying down there. They demonstrated. We reported that, straight live reporting. And then what hurt the light company was we issued a notice for people to stay away from the area. That was one. Secondly, we also told the people that you will not have electricity in that area until that problem is solved. The light company did not see that as something we were doing in their favor. They threatened to disconnect us if we don't pay them the arrears. We were owing them 4,630,000 leones. That's equivalent to about $2,500.
So because you covered the story about how the live wire killed a child and the electric company wasn't doing anything about it, because you covered the story, you might lose your electricity.
Yes, they gave us a deadline to pay. And that amount is a huge amount of money for us to pay.
So what are you going to do to try to raise the money?
When I go back, it's still unknown. I've been here for 3 weeks studying how national public radios work. When I go back, that's the issue I'm going to handle. We have a very old Russian generator sitting there. It consumes about 2 hours of diesel fuel an hour, and that bites a lot into our revenue.
Now, I know that one of the investigative stories your station has covered had to do with prostitution. What was the story?
We found out something very revealing in there, that the men who love to have sex with a prostitute and pay the prostitute more if they don't protect themselves by using condom. If they use condom, then they will pay less. This lady was actually evacuated from a war zone by a police officer who was having sex with the lady as well. And we found out that was not proper. So we decided to investigate. Then we found out that this lady, in fact, was infected with AIDS, HIV. So we tried to find out, how did you contact this aide? We found out that she was rescued from the war zone and then taken to her brother, where she was kept. For her to survive, she had to get into sex with men. And to her surprise, the men will choose to pay her more if they don't use condom and pay her less if they use condom. Now we decided to let the men know that they are responsible for the increase in the spread of AIDS. That's what we got from covering the story on prostitution.
How are men reacting to stories like that, where they're being held accountable for not using condoms?
Well, these men are usually illiterate, uneducated, so we try to let them know these facts in their own languages. We're working on it. We have 3 programs that deal with family issues. You know, the family in Sierra Leone has been broken apart. We have a youth program, which is actually a children's program. We have women to women's program. So issues like that are discussed in the women's to women's program so that the women discuss it and they are guided by it. Then we also discuss it in the men to men's program. Boy, you should be, I mean, it was very amazing how much men call in to explain that they didn't know that aid existed, so that's why they were doing that.
Do you think they honestly didn't know it existed?
Yes, there is not much education about AIDS. There is much education about tuberculosis and other diseases like malaria, but not much about AIDS at all.
What are some of the myths about AIDS that are circulating in Sierra Leone? And what is some of the most important information you think you have to broadcast in order to combat these myths?
People believe that AIDS is from Europe. It's from America. It does not exist there. And it's a man-made disease. And they don't believe it because of the marital status. You know, we have polygamous homes where the women basically don't have much saying. They don't have control over their men to decide how many women you can have, in fact, whether you should have a relationship out of your married home. So these people shift the burden of AIDS to another community. They never accept that it is within their community. They don't. They don't believe it is there. I think that's the most serious one that I will really bring out. And that is why we are trying to combat that. You have to realize it is there. Listen to this lady. Listen to the doctor. Listen to what we're telling you about the statistics. But the problem here is most of the reporters in Sierra Leone are not scientifically educated about AIDS. And I think that's one area we need to look at.
My guest is Andrew Kroma. We're talking about the radio station he founded in the city of Bo in Sierra Leone. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Kroma, and he is from Sierra Leone. He founded and runs a radio station in Bo, which is a city in Sierra Leone. And it's a radio station that has been attacked several times because of the information that it has presented that has challenged the government, challenged the rebels, and also challenged myths about AIDS. Did you study broadcasting or journalism at all?
No, I just believe in the truth. I'm an economist. I work as a research assistant for a very hard professor. And he will tell me, I remember the first time I wrote, he told me to go in and searching for data. I came up with 8 pages, and he said, God, no, I need only 1 page, and I should let you know that out of the 1 page, I'm going to reduce it to just 1 paragraph, so please go back and do it, and I need it in 2 hours. That, to me, always kept me on the line that whoever you're preparing what for, especially a document, you're trying to give information to somebody, you must thoroughly research it, and it must be important, and it must be very interesting to the people. So that has been my guide, and I've used this to run the radio station. I have actually sacked a board who did not go down with the mission. I have sacked 3 news directors. There was one time I suspended the whole newsroom and decided that they should go in for 1 week training on how to report in a violent environment.
What advice do you give your staff about how to report on a violent situation so that the information gets on the air and the staff doesn't get killed in the process?
Stay with the truth. That's one. And secondly, make sure you're not taking side. You are playing a role where you're trying to build, to create dialogue. So you don't try to favor any one group. You must balance your story. But that was very key in our reporting on the conflict, because you're looking at 2 sides. Sometimes, in fact, it became 3 sides. You have the civilians in between there. So your obligation is to the civilians to be able to decide, to listen to both sides. So that's why you go down to one side and interview, and go to the other side and interview. You stay with the truth, and nothing but the truth. Stay with it, and you are okay. So that you have the opportunity for people to believe you. I have an inscript on the wall, believability, that people must believe in what you're doing. They must believe in what you're seeing every day. And today, we have a staff that's very, very much committed to the truth.
Your radio station's call letters are KISS. Your radio station is called KISS 104. Now, there have been radio stations in the United States with those same call letters. They're usually rock radio stations. How did you come up with KISS as the name for yours?
I'm a rock fan.
Oh.
So, I'm a rock fan. Even this morning, I watch rock on the TV. Remember I went to Duke?
Right.
For some time.
To Duke University.
That was a rock area. So all that was in my mind was get a name, KISS.
So did you name it after the rock group KISS or after another rock radio station that was KISS?
This is something that was new to me. So I was just picking up a name. So I picked up a name, KISS, KISS. Simply because in the United States you have KISS, you have Capital Radio, this radio. So I chose KISS.
Okay. So do you think most of the people in Bo, where you broadcast in Sierra Leone, do you think most of them have radios? And what kind of radios do they have?
That's one of the success stories that we have made people to rely on radio. So I have pictures even in my bag with people who use their small transistor radios with them on the farm, on the village, small part village roads. They have their radios with them close to their ears. They hold their machete in one hand and the radio on the other hand. I've gone to some of the farms where you find children scaring birds away from the rice farm, and they have their radio sitting there. We have a program, we have music programs like Amulemba. It plays the kind of music they like. So they are always listening to those music and the program on their farm, on their job. So it's those small transistor radios. They go a long way, and they have a lot of them around now. It's an increasing number of radios.
Is there any TV?
No, in Bo, except a few rich diamond dealers, they have TV and video cassette players with them. But no television station that covers Bo.
What about written newspapers?
None in Bo, except Freetown.
So if you want information, you got to turn on the radio.
Yes.
What's the next big issue you're going to have to cover when you go home to Sierra Leone?
We have two transitions now that we need to make sure that we go through them properly. One is transition from war to peace. We need to make sure people contribute to development positively. And then we have transition to a true democracy. There's election coming. We want to have massive voter education. People must be educated. We must have political dialogues so that people at the end will accept the election result.
Well, I wish you good luck, and I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Andrew Kroma is the founder of two independent radio stations in his country, Sierra Leone. We spoke last week during his trip to the United States to study public radio stations here. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Rose Grower by Michel de Kretzer, a novel about France during the Reign of Terror and the cultivation of roses. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Nick Hornby, the author of High Fidelity, Fever Pitch, and About a Boy, talks about his new novel, How to Be Good. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.